Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Crossland, Corsa and Mokka. Three good reasons to visit the Opel Open Road event.
And Dr. David Coleman, clinical child psychologist, is here with advice about your parenting questions, and you can email questions to us still today, cb@rte.ie, or text us 51551. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Claire. How are you doing?
I'm very well. We have some really interesting and varied questions for you, and I'm going to start with this one. My nine-year-old daughter has developed a weight problem. It began at the first COVID lockdown, where all of our activities stopped overnight and she was snacking all the time. I was working, so it was impossible to supervise or keep her entertained, and she was bored. I had hoped that since the return of her activities, it might settle itself, but it hasn't, and she has no stop button on her appetite and will eat all the time if allowed and wants to eat constantly. She's unfit, slow, and I'm worried that she's losing out on the enjoyment of sports and other activities, as well as other long-term health implications. She's an only child. I'm struggling to get back good habits on screen time, exercise, etc. What's the best way of approaching weight loss and healthy eating with her? She's otherwise grand, good at school, very sociable, well-liked and bright. So David, this is a tricky one. What's the appropriate way to start the conversation here?
Yeah, I think in fairness, the mum probably has a good angle when she talks about the healthy eating. And I think it's always more helpful to talk about health rather than to talk about weight, because you certainly don't want to give a nine-year-old any kind of complex or sense that there's something problematic with regard to her weight, because that could develop into some other issue as she gets a little bit older. There'll be enough pressure on her potentially in terms of body image and so on as she gets a bit older. So I think if she's an only child and if there's a mum and a dad there, so there's only three, or even if it's just the mum and the daughter, you know, two or three people, I think what you could probably do is look at, you know, a whole family approach to healthier eating. So if it's the case, for example, that there were just lots of snacks available to her daughter, then it's about removing all access to those kind of snacks for everybody. And so if there's something in the house that you think, oh, it's not great that we're, you know, nibbling on chocolate, or that, you know, whenever we feel a bit snackish that we go straight for, I know, something like a bagel, you know, when they're brown bread would be healthier, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's about, I suppose, just looking at what kind of foods are you keeping in your house, and then maybe doing something as a whole family where you say, look, we're just going to change how we do our business. And so what that will do, not only for your daughter, but for the whole family, is just give a sense of leadership as parents that this is something that you're not just expecting your daughter to change, but that you're also involved in the change. Be great role modeling for your daughter. And I think it also then just creates this environment where actually as a family, you're just thinking about being healthier. And then once you've changed your eating in terms of healthiness, then you can also do more perhaps as a family in terms of your activities. So it's again not just sending her out to be active and to do sports, but maybe as a family, you know, taking a couple more walks even in the week, or maybe, you know, if you can have time at the weekend, maybe go somewhere, you know, like a beach or somewhere where you just do something a bit different but a bit more energetic as a family.
Okay, so it's all led by the adults in the house. I'm just looking at what this parent says about the lack of a stop button when the child is eating. How can she help her daughter just to be more mindful around food? So if the adult isn't snacking and isn't eating, isn't grazing, but the child is continuing to do it, that's a very difficult problem, isn't it?
It is. And so, again, you know, there's lots of, when you look at how people eat and how people have eaten, you know, I mean, I think humans back in the past would have always eaten when food was available and stored, you know, up in terms of their eating in case there were lean times ahead. So the idea of kind of grazing or just eating if food is available is not that uncommon. And so, again, it's predominantly, though, with a nine-year-old about habit. So look at your portion sizes. When, you know, if she has no way to say stop in terms of the amount of food, then it is up to the parents, the adults there, to regulate that for her for the time being. And so look at the portion sizes, make sure that you're not giving her too much at each meal. It may be that, you know, again, if you're giving her small portions, that you could then plan to have seconds. And so that might help her feel a little bit more satiated if she's kind of feels like she's getting a little bit more of whatever the dinner is. But again, it's about the parents regulating that. And again, probably leading by example and just being careful that they're not also overeating, or that they're not also diving for the snacks, the crisps, the whatever it is, that if they're feeling peckish.
Now, well, let's move on to this next one. A question in this case has arisen for this family about sexuality. My question is regarding my daughter, who's almost 12. At the Halloween weekend, she said, "Mammy, I'm pan." My reaction was to say, "What is pan?" And she said, "It's, you know, when someone likes boys, girls or transgender." Because my reaction was one of shock, simply because I hadn't heard of pansexuality as a term, she said I looked disappointed. I asked her to come over and sit on my lap and I said, "Not at all, it's just I hadn't heard the term and whatever your sexuality is fine by me. I didn't know what to say because it came from nowhere. I don't have an issue with this, but I want to make sure that I managed it correctly by saying I was glad she told me, as she said she planned on telling me when she was 13. And the question is she not very young, this parent says, to really know her sexuality? Is this common in preteens to explore this idea? Is there anything I should do in the meantime, or do I just wait for my daughter's cues? Your advice, David, would be most appreciated there." So, David, the questions there, let's start with the first one. Is she very young to really know her sexuality?
I think she's very young to be fully definitive about it, although I think most of us probably have had experience of having a sense of our sexuality that then grew and developed as we moved into our teenage years. Things kind of became more clear for us. But most people, if they look back, will say, "Oh yeah, I knew I liked boys or I knew I liked girls back, you know, when I was 11. But at that age, I suppose, you know, we weren't really thinking in a sexual way, because that's part of what we would have called the latency period. You know, when our sexuality kind of faded into the background and just wasn't a very significant thing for us. Typically with the advent of adolescence and puberty, that brings issues of kind of sex and sexuality and changes to our bodies right to the fore. And so, again, that's typically when we expect teenagers, young teenagers, to begin to grapple with the idea of their sexuality. But it's not unusual that they might know or have a sense of what their sexuality is. The fact that, you know, this girl is saying that she's pansexual, again, that's probably for most parents, I would imagine, a very new term. And again, I think, you know, has probably become more widespread with the way the internet has brought kind of sexuality and issues about kind of sexual behavior right to the fore for preteens as well. And I think that is probably the bigger issue, that as parents, it's almost like we, you know, the internet has kind of forced kids into jumping the gun almost with regard to thinking about their sexuality. And so as parents, then we also need to respond by becoming more literate about, you know, issues about sex, sexuality and relationships, and probably start talking to our kids way before we would have thought to talk to them. You know, most of us have a sense of, we'll have the talk with our child. But that talk, if you're to consider it in that term, probably needs to happen when they're about 10 or 11. And I also think it's useful to think of it less as an event where you just do one big talk about sex, sexuality and relationships, but more about a process. And so in many ways, I think, you know, her daughter has come to her with the term, and she as a mom reacted, I think, very naturally, very normally, and also very supportively, and said, "Look, you know, I don't have an issue with that. I just, you know, I was surprised because I hadn't come across it. But, you know, however you feel is fine by me." And I think what that does then is allow this girl, as she now grows and develops over the next 3, 4, 5 years, probably to have lots of space and time, and to know that it's okay to talk to her mom about whatever might be going on in terms of herself and her feelings and her both experience of her sexuality and then her expression of her sexuality. Hopefully she'll feel confident to talk to her mom about all those things.
So is that what the mother should do then? Just give the child space to work this through? Does she just wait for her cues, in other words?
Yes, I think so. Although I think it's fair for any parent of an 11-year-old to reinforce the idea that she's very young to be thinking about doing anything in terms of sexual behavior, and that certainly as a mom, you wouldn't necessarily be happy with her thinking about doing something with somebody, irrespective of how she felt, whether she thought she liked them or not, that there will come an age when sexual behavior might become okay, but certainly 11, 12 is not it. And I think, you know, that's, again, just giving some kind of guidance and direction to her daughter with regard to, you know, whatever about how she feels, you know, what she does. You know, there still need to be some limits around that.
Okay, this one now is from a granny, David. My grandson is 2.5 years old. His nighttime sleep pattern is very poor. He can wake around 1 or 2 a.m. every night, stay awake for 4 to 5 hours. 4 to 5 hours, oh my goodness. And he gets, he gets very upset when he's awake during the night. This has been going on for a few months and the entire family is very sleep deprived. You see, you look at that when you've been through, you know, that age group as a parent and you think that time will pass. But if you're in the middle of that and you're awake every night for 5 hours, that's crippling for everybody.
Yeah, it's horrendous. It really is horrendous because, of course, if your child is waking at 2 and then they're finally falling asleep about 6:30, good chance you've probably got to be getting up shortly thereafter anyway. And so any chance you've had as a parent for your own sleep is gone. So there's a couple of things. If both parents are there, then I think sometimes it can help to feel like you're taking night on, night off, just that it's very clear which parent is going to have to be the one to respond. Because, you know, if there's a kind of a cry or a call or the child comes into them, depending on whether he's in a cot still or whether he's actually in a big boy bed yet. But, you know, a lot of that will depend, I think, for the parents. They just need to be clear who's going to be the one to respond. So that means that the other parent, if you like, can at least just roll over and go back to sleep. And then they know that it's going to be their turn the following night. I'd be interested to know how do they do their bedtimes in the first instance. So what kind of bedtime routine do they have? How, when they're putting their child to bed in the night before, how do they go about that? Because again, what would be really helpful is if they could try to mimic whatever the routine or the circumstances are again, if their son wakes up in the middle of the night. Because if he feels that there's a different response, then it may be that, again, he's just not back in this routine of knowing that he needs to fall back asleep. So if they do story time, then it might be that they need to do the same kind of thing. If they would normally sit with him when he goes to sleep at the start of the night, you know, then they need to be ready to do that with him again. And often the idea of a checking visit is more useful for small children. If they know that their parent is going to come back to check on them, it allows them to just feel that little bit of security. And then when they feel that bit of security, then it's easier for them to fall back asleep. And so that might be something, you know, if as a parent they tend to try and get back into their own bed and just don't want to be disturbed, and so the next time the cry comes they think, oh, I'll just leave that now, I won't go back. And but if instead you set up a routine where you're calling into your child, literally coming to the door, just not letting them see that you're there, checking on them every 5 minutes, it may be that that will drop to, you know, I mean, it's still disruptive, but even if it dropped to him only taking an hour to fall back asleep, well then at least that leaves a lot more of the night for the parents to get a bit more sleep as well. But that will reduce when their son feels a little bit more security, that there is somebody checking on him, but that still the expectation is that it's nighttime, it's sleep time, and that it's not about, you know, chit chat and get up and play and whatever else.
See, there has to be a way to solve that problem, but when you're really exhausted, it's hard to find the solution, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that's probably why it's a granny contacting us and not the parents themselves. They're probably so in the midst of it that they can't even see the wood for the trees.
Yeah.
You know, they're probably just going on autopilot. So it's great that that somebody else has an eye to the stresses, the pressures that are coming on the family, and how that gets translated back then in terms of the support also that could be offered is important. Because, you know, I mean, there's a granny who recognizes that whether it's her son, daughter and partner are under pressure, you know, then it's about making sure that, you know, is there anything practical maybe that the granny could do? You know, could she maybe, if depending on her age and energy levels, could she go and do a nighttime shift even once a week or twice a week? Because that also might then give the parents just that chance to get a bit of rest themselves, which allowed them to think a bit clearer and then hopefully maybe move to resolving something about the sleep habits and sleep patterns.
Okay, well, we wish them well getting through that. This is a fairly concerning one now next, David, about an 11-year-old. Hi, David. My daughter is home from school since August with generalized anxiety disorder. She's 11. We're dealing with child and adult mental health services, but our caseworker is off sick. Private psychiatrist appointments have a 12-month waiting list. We have huge amount emotional outbursts, and on occasion she says there's no point in living. Please help.
Wow. Okay. So they're already dealing with CAMHS. So CAMHS, for those who haven't yet come across them, are the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. And so every area in Ireland will have its own CAMHS team. And so typically it's a team comprised of psychiatrists, psychologists, sometimes speech and language therapists, psychiatric nurses. So there's various different people involved in a team. And I think the one really good thing about having a team is that even if one person in that team is missing, then there should be support from somebody else in the team. And given that this mum or dad is saying that their daughter occasionally says that there's no point in living, I would be going back to the CAMHS team saying, look, whoever I normally deal with, I know that they're off sick or that they're not around, but somebody needs to support us. Somebody needs to meet with my daughter. She's really, really struggling. And this is how bad it feels to her, because, you know, any child, I think, who's considering that life is not worth living, I think needs to become a priority. And so that's certainly where I would go in the first instance, is to just go back and really put pressure on that somebody else within that team, hopefully, could follow up with them and support their daughter.
David, thank you very much indeed. And we wish that family well dealing with that very difficult challenge. And if you have a question on parenting for Dr. David Coleman, for him to address the next time he's on, email us now and we'll put it to David when we talk to him again. The email address is todaycb@rte.ie.